From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The headlines keep coming on the NSA. Supreme Court rejects NSA lawsuit. NSA itself releases internal documents yesterday showing secret court judicial oversight struggling to stay on top of massive spying operations inside this country. Congress is divided over whether and how to put new restraints into law, laws that would fit new threats, new technologies, and our old concepts of freedom. After the drama of leaks and revelation comes the what now question. This hour on Point, what are we as a country going to do with the NSA? And in this hour, we will take a moment to remember again to honor Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address on the 150th anniversary today of its delivery. But first, to the NSA and all that's come out since Edward Snowden began his leaks over the summer. At this point, people have all kinds of views of Edward Snowden. But let's listen back to just a moment to when the former NSA contractor turned leaker sat down in June in a Hong Kong hotel room with The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald to talk about his decision to blow the whistle, to leak. And he said his biggest concern was that the American public was what the American public would do with the information he was making public to the world. His concern that the public would do nothing.
The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessarily to stand up and fight to change things.
Leaker Edward Snowden in June at the beginning of this whole saga of revelation. Now we're into it. We're at the point where the rubber meets the road or doesn't. Yesterday, there was action on a couple of fronts. One of them was the Supreme Court. Adam Liptak is Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. He joins us now from Washington. Adam, thank you very much for being with us. What did the court decide to do or not to do yesterday, Adam?
The court turned away an unusual challenge to an aspect of one of these surveillance programs. It wasn't a particularly big or surprising decision because the group that brought the challenge did something unusual. It filed directly in the Supreme Court rather than, as in the usual case, filing in a lower court and appealing it up the line. But it does illuminate a significant issue, which is that it's going to be very hard to get from the Supreme Court an answer on the constitutionality of these programs. In February, it already once turned away a different challenge, saying that the people who had brought it could not prove that they'd been spied on and so didn't have legal standing to sue. So you can separate out several questions here. What are these programs? Are they good policy? And are they constitutional? And on that third question, I suspect it's going to be very hard to find a way to make the Supreme Court answer that third question.
There are, of course, other challenges in the courts. I hope you can help us look at them a little bit. But just so we understand the court's move yesterday, this was the Electronic Privacy Information Center. They've been very outspoken asking for new restraints, challenges legally to the NSA's activity. What specifically were they asking the court to consider, Adam?
They were focused in on the secret court that approves warrants in this area, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and it said that that court had gone beyond its jurisdiction in allowing the bulk collection of Americans' phone records. And, you know, the fact that we have this secret court that hears only from one side, from which there seems to be no possibility of appeal, is itself a very odd part of the American legal system. So it's possible to be sympathetic to the frustration of the Electronic Privacy Information Center of saying, well, we can't get into that court, and yet now you're telling us we can't challenge the jurisdiction of that court directly in the Supreme Court. You got to do it yet some third way.
So kind of a black box with no way in there, and the court just simply made it clear it's going to do nothing on this. What about lower courts? What's bubbling up there? Are there challenges, cases that could get to the merits and the deep legal questions that many now see here?
Yes, there are at least two sets of cases, and one of them is particularly promising. So one set of cases are sort of follow-ons to what the Supreme Court turned back in February, saying people didn't have standing. But that was before the Snowden revelations, where it becomes tolerably clear that lots and lots of people are subject to government surveillance. So there's sort of fresh runs at that in civil cases in several federal trial courts. More interesting yet, the government just recently informed a criminal defendant that they intended to use material against him gathered through one of these programs, and that means that person almost surely has standing and can move to suppress the information, arguing that it violates his Fourth Amendment rights. And that criminal case, I think, is a likely vehicle at least to get past the standing problem and maybe to get past other kinds of threshold legal concerns and maybe actually get a merits decision from the courts.
Adam, you cover all this. Could the constitutional issues raised here be settled in a lower court? Is it inevitable that they would come to the Supreme Court? The government's been aggressive in protecting these powers. And why do you say that the country is unlikely to get a decision from the Supreme Court that would speak to the constitutional issues here? Aren't these major constitutional questions?
So you asked two questions. Mm-hmm. The first of them is, could this be settled by a lower court? It depends what answer the lower court gives. If the lower court strikes down a federal statute or a federal law as unconstitutional, the Supreme Court will almost surely review that. Mm-hmm. But if it says this is okay, it's possible the Supreme Court ducks the issue. Several justices have said that they're not particularly comfortable in this area, that national security is a matter for the political branches. So I don't think it's a lock that the Supreme Court, using its discretion to hear cases or not, necessarily hears the case. And if it does hear the case, it may well find a way not to reach the merits, as it already has once this year.
But aren't these gigantic constitutional questions? Isn't there some... This seems to me some mismatch there between the questions on the table and the court's unlikelihood to pick them up.
I hear what you're saying. You sort of have this feeling about the Supreme Court that they should give us the last word on every constitutional question, and maybe they will, but maybe they won't.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Adam, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure.
There's a lot going on beyond the court. In Congress, a major debate. The president has acknowledged this. This was a little bit from a November 7th interview with NBC's Chuck Todd. President Obama saying the NSA has a real technological edge now over other nations when it comes to intelligence gathering, but also now over America's own laws governing privacy and spying.
Technology has given us so much more reach than in the past.
So your job is to create restraint?
Now we've got to adapt the architecture of what we do to our capacity. In some ways, the technology and the budgets and the capacity have outstripped the constraints.
Outstripped the constraints. That seems fairly clear. Let's look more widely at what's going on in Washington in the debate over what to do with the NSA. Siobhan Gorman is national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal based in Washington, joins us now. Siobhan, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be with you.
So take us to Capitol Hill. I mean, I guess the executive branch is not looking to rein this in. Am I right? And if not, what's going on in Congress?
Well, the executive branch has sort of approached very gingerly this idea of, quote unquote, reining in the NSA. Most of the positions that the administration has laid out have been consistent with what the intelligence agencies have been suggesting, which is, well, you know, maybe there are ways to incorporate more reporting requirements on NSA activities and to make some information about the activities more public. But fundamentally, they're not really looking to change the programs. And then there's obviously a rather large collection of lawmakers on Capitol Hill that feels that much more drastic action needs to be taken, that some of these programs need to literally be shut down.
What's the focus of that interest, that attention? What kind of levers are they looking to pull here or changes to make?
Well, there's a collection of both senators and House members, including Senator Ron Wyden, who's been very vocal on this. He's on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Senator Patrick Leahy, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who want to, among other things, pass legislation that would shut down these so-called bulk collection data programs that NSA has. The main one that people have focused on has to do with NSA's collection of nearly all American phone records.
Not to mention email.
Well, email's a little bit different because NSA says that that was shut down in 2011, mm-hmm. so this legislation wouldn't affect that program. However, people still ask questions about, well, what kinds of activities in terms of internet data are still underway?
Wyden and Patrick Leahy, both Democrats. We've heard about Rand Paul opposition here as well. Are there Republicans who are speaking up against NSA, the reach of its activity, especially in this country?
Indeed. Certainly Rand Paul and their the interesting thing about this issue is that it really cuts across party lines, and the way that the sort of pro and con factions have divided up on Capitol Hill have more to do with almost leadership and establishment versus somewhat more maverick in some cases, but also just not necessarily the ones who have been brought into the club when it has to do with these intelligence programs. And so it's kind of the insider and outsider factions that are battling over what to do about NSA surveillance.
Maverick in this case, interestingly, meaning maybe more focused on the U.S. Constitution, but there are big security issues here as well. Siobhan Gorman with The Wall Street Journal. Please stand by. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what to do with the NSA, looking at its massive spying powers up against the law, civil liberties, privacy, oversight, and all in the context of big security questions. We're looking at who's pushing for and against what on whether to rein in the NSA. Siobhan Gorman of the Wall Street Journal joins us, national security correspondent there. We'll hear from a couple of big legal scholars with an interest, a very real interest in this as well in just a moment. Siobhan, just today, or I guess yesterday, the NSA put a lot of new documents out there. Now, we've been hearing that it was their intention to get ahead of the Snowden links because the word is that there's a lot more to come from Snowden. Was this part of an NSA effort to get ahead of those, to sort of reveal before the leaker can reveal, or was this more targeted?
It's a little bit hard to know because the government certainly didn't indicate to us whether or not they thought that some of the documents released last night were of the type that Mr. Snowden would have been expected to release down the line. What we've actually seen, though, is the government several times now actually putting out information about NSA's handling of these programs that have been a lot more critical and kind of damning than anything that Mr. Snowden has put out. It's not clear that Mr. Snowden had access to this vast array of, for example, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court opinions. Obviously, he had some of them, but the government has actually put out several of them now, all which kind of condemn NSA's management of these programs. What we saw yesterday was a pretty strong criticism of NSA's handling of this internet data collection program that we referenced a little earlier in the show, which General Alexander, head of the NSA, said that they shut down in 2011.
Mm-hmm. And this was the chief judge on the FISA court who was being critical.
Yes, and that's actually a pattern that we've seen. We've seen the chief judge of the FISA court at various points in time because it's a position that does rotate through. They've been highly critical also of NSA's handling of the phone data records program, which does continue, and the continuing program at NSA to tap the internet backbone within the U.S. To collect both data and content of communications there. And so we've actually seen pretty across the board court criticism of NSA's management of these major surveillance programs.
And what's the substance of that criticism? You call it damning. Maybe in these latest revelations pages released or earlier, what are they pointing to specifically with what kind of damning critique?
Well, basically that NSA is not not knowledgeable enough about its own programs to accurately describe it to the court, to its superiors at the Pentagon, and that basically on a regular basis, NSA is running programs that are outside of what is ordered by the court. They're collecting more data than what the court has allowed, and in this case, it's more American data than what the court had allowed on the Internet Data Program.
What's the implication of the release of this damning critique from within the current system? Is there an implication of change, or it's just airing the laundry? Does it add up to something different to be expected?
Well, I think it's interesting because it kind of keeps going to this larger question of, is NSA capable of managing these huge complex programs that it has developed? None of these court opinions have suggested that NSA was willfully doing these violations. And in fact, that has often been NSA's defense. You know, they say, well, we aren't willfully going outside of the court orders. These things happen by accident, but they seem to be really large accidents. And that does raise a question of whether these are manageable programs.
But that takes a sense of deliberate intention out of these oversteps. Was the FISA court judicial leaders buying that?
I think generally they were, but, you know, they're still not pleased that NSA doesn't seem to understand its programs well enough to execute them the way they claim that they're going to execute them. And that seems to be a consistent problem, not just with this program, which was apparently shut down, but with other programs that are ongoing.
These are huge questions for the American public and the government. Siobhan Gorman, please stand by in Washington. It's so great to have you with us. I want to bring a couple of good legal minds in here. With us from George Washington University School of Law in Washington, Orrin Kerr joins us. Orrin Kerr, welcome back to On Point. Very good to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be back.
And from New York, Jonathan Hafitz joins us, professor at Seton Hall Law School, expert on constitutional law, national security, human rights, a former senior attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union. Jonathan Hafitz, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Jonathan, first to you. Do you see the federal government or the Congress beginning to get a handle on all that we've learned about the NSA? Do you see the stirring of new controls here, or are we rolling toward, over time, acceptance of what we've seen and learned?
I certainly see movement. The developments come, you know, fast and furious. But there really seems to be a movement, and that the status quo does not seem sustainable. So you've got kind of action in the courts, and you've got action in Congress. And I think one or the other is going to lead to some kind of change. I mean, it just doesn't seem, you know, sustainable that things are left in place as they are.
What kind of change can you imagine that would leave the government ready to say that it's protecting the American people as best it can within constitutional constraints, a balance people would accept that would be different from now? Where might we look to expect change if it goes in that direction?
I think with respect to the mass collection of phone data or metadata, I think you might see a change in terms of the current statutory language, which just does not match what's really going on. The statute seems to need to be adjusted to reflect or to rein in, either way, the current bulk data collection. And I think there may be another series of reforms. Even if you allow for bulk collection, there are a number of different steps that can be taken in terms of minimization procedures, what's done with the information, in terms of there's talk about for a special advocate to be able to argue before the FISA court, so it's not so one-sided. So I think there are a number of other reforms to make the program more balanced and to add checks, because right now you get the sense of a program that's out of control, not managed, and unchecked and unbalanced. And I think the American public knows and feels that.
We heard just today in a story from NPR's Tom Gelton from Ann Neuberger, a special assistant to the General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, and her indication was that it was very difficult not to look at everything because the bad guy communications and the good guy communications are all mixed together. Here she was talking with Tom Gelton.
We'd love to magically segregate bad guys' comms, as we call them, right? And good guys' comms. You can't technically do it. They're intermixed. Communications are fundamentally intermixed today.
Jonathan Hafetz, that's that sort of you can't handle the truth put very sweetly there, but, you know, it's all intermixed. And we've got to have it all to get the bad guys. What about that argument, Jonathan?
Well, I think it's there's an appeal to it, but I think that at some point the notion that we can be able to, you know, we should be able to do everything in order or anything in order to counter a security, you know, a potential security threat wears thin, especially when you get a sense that the program is not being carefully managed and is excessive. So I think that that argument allows for deference. It allows for you know, broad powers, but it doesn't allow for the seemingly almost, you know, unlimited kind of authority that's being wielded now.
Orrin Kerr in Washington, can this country, by whatever institution, and one wonders if there's any that will ultimately really take this on. One, it's interesting that we wonder, but can it restrain, constrain the NSA activity that we've seen in these Snowden revelations and maintain reasonable national security?
Surely it can. The question is whether the political branches want to do that. I do think this is primarily an issue for Congress more than the courts. Really, we're dealing here with major policy questions more than constitutional questions, and that really means it's an issue for the Congress of the United States, which then ultimately means it's an issue for the people and their public opinions to be, you know, translated into congressional action. And a key date to keep in mind here is 2015, which is when the current power to conduct the bulk collection program expires. So the statute called Section 215, which has been interpreted by the courts, the secret court, to allow the bulk collection program, has an expiration date on it. And that means that within 2 years or so, big debate will happen in about a year, the executive branch is going to have to come to Congress and seek renewal of the program, and that will basically reverse the usual presumption. In other words, instead of having to amend the statute to control the power, there will have to be an enactment of the statute to allow the program. So that's I think, the really big congressional debate, and that should be happening sometime in about the next year.
Jonathan Hafetz, are you ready to wait for that amount of time to address these things? If the country accepts this, over that period of time, before that expiration of the explicit current powers, is it not, you know, having seen these revelations, having learned, doesn't it kind of become the status quo? Doesn't it kind of get grandfathered in as we wait?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think the longer that it goes on, there's a sense of acquiescence. But remember, I mean, the programs have been, you know, until recently largely secret. I think one of the interesting things, keeping in mind that 2015 date, is the current court challenges, which are moving forward there, including the challenges, the civil suits that have been brought, which challenge the interpretation and application of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And so the courts, I think there may be sufficient momentum and sufficient pressure for the courts to weigh in, to find standing, which I think is a strong argument now, and also to say, you know, look, this statute does not – the authorization in 215 is narrower than what's going on. And so that, I think, intervention by the courts, even the lower courts, putting aside the Supreme Court, could force some political action even before the 2015 date.
Siobhan Gorman, what about right in front of us here? There's an annual Pentagon kind of approval that comes before Congress that some are trying to use now. Some of those who want to see reform, constraint, I guess they're trying to put it in, make it part of this Pentagon sign-off that Congress has to give. What's the push on that front, Siobhan?
Well, I think what we're going to see is this legislation that was referenced earlier to try to end this so-called bulk collection under the Patriot Act is likely to be attached to any sort of semi-connected bill that is moving through Congress, and we'll probably see that for the next year and a half or so until, as Professor Kerr mentioned, this section of the act is set to expire. So I think you'll probably see action kind of continuously between now and then, but it seems like the debate will really probably heat up at some point next year.
The people's voice going to matter here in terms of pressure, as we're hearing right now. We're looking at the NSA and moves to restrain its powers or not. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to our listeners. Kent, Ohio, Theodore's calling. Hi, Theodore. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for a wonderful program. First of all, I would like to say that I think Edward Snowden should be considered a national hero, and I have written in letters to the editor about just that issue. But more fundamentally, I think everyone listening should reread or read, if they haven't, George Orwell's 1984, because he spoke of this very clearly when he said, Big Brother is watching you. Big Brother is the NSA, and they are watching us. And we need to be very, very cautious about that, because it's dangerous. And I think Orwell hit the nail right on the head with Big Brother is watching you. So basically, that's what I wanted to say.
You have the perspective of Snowden as a hero. Not everybody does. But what's with that perspective, what's your confidence that the government will act to rein the NSA in, Theodore, as we sit here today?
I have very little confidence that they will act to rein the NSA in, because I think Congress is essentially dysfunctional at the moment. They've already shut the government down. Most of us out here, I think it's fair to say, have lost confidence in our Congress, and that's terribly dangerous and terribly unfortunate.
Theodore, I appreciate your call from Kent, Ohio. Thanks very much. One more right here from Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I think the 500-pound gorilla in the room everyone is failing to mention is 9/11. Without 9/11, we're probably not even having this conversation. I think those events and the technology advances, as Mr. Obama cited earlier in the clip you played, are what make this necessary. Well, it's what makes it even, it's occurring because of those things. I can't imagine what future president or what future NSA official is going to want to be the one in office when the next big one hits. And that being the case, they're not going to stop doing this. This is the norm. This isn't an aberration anymore. This is the way it is. This is the way it will be for the foreseeable future.
Is it Orwellian to you, Kevin, or is it?
Oh, yes, it is. I don't like it, but I understand that this is the way it's going to be because specifically of 9/11.
Kevin, I appreciate your call. Jonathan Hafitz, we saw 9/11. We took that shock. We have this technology that's growing and growing, and our caller kind of despairs of it, but nevertheless says no one's going to have the political nerve not to use these capacities when, you know, another big one could hit.
Well, I think there's some truth to that in the extent that 9/11 and the fear of terrorism is going to continually push for, you know, use of the available technology. The question is whether they're going to be checks and balances. And in the end of the day, I think having those checks and balances will make the surveillance activities more sustainable and more effective. I mean, right now you get a sense of a program that has no checks and balances, and I think that putting it on a more firm footing will put it on a firmer footing and make it more sustainable.
Siobhan, in the testimony we've seen from the leaders of the NSA, I haven't heard any readiness on their part to back away from this capacity. I mean, they seem to be saying, we've got this power, we need this power, we're going to use this power, period.
Yeah, the last time we saw the heads of the various intelligence agencies, including NSA and the Director of National Intelligence, they had a very strong defense of these programs, saying that they were absolutely necessary to keep Americans safe. There's another hearing coming up this Thursday where we'll hear from a similar set of leaders as well, and that it will be another opportunity. One issue, though, that people haven't focused in on quite as much is whether or not NSA would actually be more effective if it were more targeted, as opposed to kind of focusing on these sweeping programs.
It's a good point. We'll pick it up. Siobhan Gorman with The Wall Street Journal. Please stand by. Orrin Kerr, Jonathan Hafitz. We're looking at what to do with the NSA. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what to do with the NSA, looking at its massive spying powers up against the law, civil liberties, privacy, oversight, and the security challenge. We're looking at who's pushing for and against what. on whether to rein it in. Lots of response online. On Facebook, Dave says Congress needs to get involved. The Tea Party GOP should be all over this. Others not so keen on Edward Snowden. Wahoo says Snowden's no hero. He's an egomaniac. He does not deserve American citizenship. Don says clearly even those who favor the highest levels of transparency should agree that the broad release of NSA documents has caused harm in our foreign relations. But here's the big question. This kind of goes to your point, Siobhan, perhaps, about the NSA, the effectiveness of some of this. Why, writes to us, he says, return the NSA to its proper role, spying outside the USA. The internal spying program has been ineffective. He says, and fact check us here, Siobhan, but he says that the Christmas Day plot to blow up a jet over Detroit, foiled by a flight attendant and a Dutch citizen. Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, stopped by passengers as well. The Times Square bombing, foiled by an immigrant hot dog vendor. The NSA internal spying program failed to detect the Boston Marathon bombers before they wreaked their havoc. He writes, the NSA spying renders our persons and papers unsecure and does nothing to protect the American people. Siobhan, what about the record with all this massive spying here?
Well, I think that the caller raises an important point. In fact, one of the examples that was raised shortly after Mr. Snowden's documents started coming fast and furiously was the Boston bombing. And in fact, there were lawmakers that said, you know, this call records program was used in the Boston bombing. But then we, you know, you probe a little bit and you learn, well, yes, it was used as a forensics experiment after the Boston bombing to try to figure out where those phone calls had connected. And so there are still serious questions about whether or not having these vast volumes of data, is more effective than just doing normal lead-driven investigation.
Let's go to Amy in New Orleans, Louisiana. Amy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is following up on a couple of things that have been discussed already, and it is, in your guests' legal opinions, is what is happening under the NSA right now, is it legally allowable under the Patriot Act? Because my opinion is that after 9/11, our Congress and government was very happy to pass laws like the Patriot Act that really went against what we understood our constitutional rights were before that, and the American people were very tolerant of that at the time. And I find it a little hypocritical at the moment for Congress to be so rabid about this when, after 9/11, everybody was sort of sleepwalking. But
and now they're saying, hey, we didn't mean that, or some are anyway.
And it's I think it's fine to change our minds. You know, that was then, this is now.
Yep.
But I just want to know, and your guest did discuss this earlier, but really, is this allowable under the Patriot Act? I understand we can let that go, but that's my question.
I think there are questions around that. I appreciate yours, Amy. Oren Kerr, what about it? Legal under the Patriot Act as passed, or a twisted interpretation to permit some of these activities?
A twisted interpretation. I don't think the Patriot Act authorized anything like the bulk records collection. And it brings up an important point. The Patriot Act is actually a much more modest law than most people thought. You know, there's hysteria on both sides here. There's hysteria about the terrorist threat, and there's hysteria about the civil liberties threat, with some people saying, you know, we need to do anything we can to avoid a next 9/11. Other people saying we're in George Orwell territory and it's all like 1984.
Yep.
I reject both of those extremes. I think we need to look at trying to strike the proper balance in light of the actual threat and in light of what works. And we ultimately, this is an issue for Congress to consider. The statute that Congress passed in the Patriot Act and then later amended does not seem on its face to authorize anything like the bulk collection program. I think it was misinterpreted by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to authorize it. And so that's part of the problem, is we seem to have a statute that points in one way to allow a much more limited collection, a program which the court has court has authorized this program under the statute, and there's just a mismatch between those two.
Jonathan Hafitz, in that case, it seems as though some of this activity is kind of floated free from law. If it's beyond what the Patriot Act imagined or explicitly permits, how do we get it back under control when it's become policy?
Well, I think, two ways. You have the political movement in Congress, but you have the courts. And, I agree with Professor Kerr that it is a twisted and distorted interpretation of Section 215. I just see a role for the courts to play, particularly if you have a sort of a deadlock or in Congress where things are not moving. And I think that the courts here can and will play, or not necessarily will, but are likely to play a role if Congress doesn't act, because the statute is just so is just so far apart from what's and such a mismatch with what's going on. In a sense, it reminds me, in some sense, of the early days of the Guantanamo cases, where you have these incredibly broad claims of executive and government power, mm-hmm. and that seemed to be beyond what a law would allow, and the courts then, when the political branches aren't doing anything, the courts coming in and playing a role, and that ends up getting Congress involved. And I think in a sense we may have something like that going on here now, where the courts are going to feel compelled to step in.
But is there a catch-22 there? I mean, we heard at the top of the hour from Adam Liptak covering the Supreme Court for the New York Times, who said, well, if a lower court moves to affirm the government spying powers, that will settle that. But if they move to rein in those powers, it will certainly be appealed to the Supreme Court by the government, and the Supreme Court, as it sits today, is unlikely to act on this. Do you agree, Jonathan?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, there are a number of different ways the Supreme Court can avoid the issue, but I think there's going to be a lot of pressure in the lower courts to act, not to dismiss the cases on standing grounds. I think they're different than the previous round of cases. And second, I think that the problem with the statute and the mismatch between the statute and the bulk collection activities is a hard one for a court to resolve. And remember, if a court rules on a statutory ground, it's just putting it back in Congress's court, and Congress can then act to try to adjust the statute. I mean, they're real underlying constitutional issues, which we haven't talked about, but under the Fourth Amendment. But I think the big issue right now, the big target, is the statute.
Siobhan, you're a kind of neutral party here. What do you anticipate if the High Court is unlikely to come in and say this has to stop, constraints are necessary to support the Constitution? If they're not going to do that, is Congress likely to move in a substantive way here, Siobhan? What's your best guess?
Well, it seems like it's really a jump ball right now. I mean, you've got highly divided groups on Capitol Hill. I mean, you have the heads of the intelligence committees largely pitted against the heads of the judiciary committees, and then an array of civil liberties advocates from both parties lining up with the folks on the judiciary committees. So it's very hard to see, and I think that what is really going to happen is there will be a forcing function, at least in terms of how the fate of the bulk collection programs, because it is set to expire in 18 months or so, and that will force some sort of decision to be made. But right now, it's not at all clear. I mean, remember back in 2008 when we were having the debate about warrantless surveillance, there was lots of uproar. And ultimately, what happened was Congress not only ratified what the Bush administration was doing, saying, okay, it's okay to do this program, mm-hmm. just do it under the observation of the FISA court. And by the way, it doesn't have to just be terrorism. You can do this kind of spying in most cases for all foreign intelligence purposes. And so, Congress doesn't always move to rein things in. Last time, essentially, we saw an expansion, albeit with some oversight from the courts, but we've now seen in subsequent documents of course, that the court is limited in its ability to oversee these programs.
This enormous, quiet, unceasing pressure to keep it going. Reed in Asheville, North Carolina. Reed, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I just feel like the NSA is akin to a madman speeding down the highway, running people off the road, injuring people, and all we're trying to do is say, oh, we should have a discussion about this fellow, and we should raise the speed limit and just let him go on his merry way, when clearly the Fourth Amendment is there, and in my opinion, they're going way, way past where they should be going. So
you don't want to raise the speed limit. You don't want to keep the liberty to act so wide here for the NSA.
Correct.
Thank you, Reed. One more, Dan, Ashland, Wisconsin. Dan, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Tom. My comment is I don't think we need to rein in the NSA, and if the government would tap my phone or my electronic communications and that would lead to greater national security, it's fine with me.
You know, Dan, I hear people say that, and it makes me think, I don't know how old you are, but think back to the Cold War days, and, you know, we used to express a lot of concern about what went on behind the Iron Curtain, East Germany and all the rest, where there was massive surveillance of, you know, their own population. Are you saying, hey, everything's changed, even in this country, home of the, you know, free and the brave, it doesn't matter?
What I'm saying is that I don't think that I have anything to hide. I don't think that I'm at any risk if I were monitored by our government. I think they and I think that there may be people that have nefarious plans that might be discovered if a wide array of investigation occurred.
So there's the political view, you know, sort of from the populace saying, "Bring it on, Orrin Kerr." What about the stakes here around American freedom? We're going to hear in just a moment a reading of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address for the 150th anniversary of that today. You know, how should we look at these very extensive powers in light of the Constitution that we, you know, fought intellectually and physically to make the law of the land?
Well, I don't think there are constitutional issues raised by the kind of NSA surveillance programs we're talking about. This is dealing with non-content information, that is, information about, say, phone calls rather than the actual contents of the call. So it's really a public policy debate. And as the last two calls suggest, public opinion is divided. And what tends to happen when public opinion is divided is nothing. So right now, there's sort of very little getting through Congress at all. And on issues on which the public is divided, it's unlikely for anything to happen. And what's the key date to keep in mind, 2015, in about 18 months, this program expires, and that flips the default. So at that point, the executive branch is going to have to get some sort of legislation passed in order to continue some form of this bulk collection program. And so the default is going to be the program ends at that point, and then we'll really see the public debate. So the debate is coming, and just different people have different instincts on these issues, and it's going to be an issue ultimately for the elected branches and for Congress to decide.
Jonathan Hafitz, no constitutional questions raised by the bulk collection surveillance of the NSA. What do you say?
Well, I understand where Professor Kerr is coming from and the existing precedents, but I think there are important constitutional issues, and they're kind of the next forefront of some Fourth Amendment issues where you've got long-term monitoring and aggregation of data. It's true it's not the content of phone calls, but there's so much because of the technology, just by looking at the metadata, there's so much you can learn that it is an area where people have a reasonable expectation of privacy and the government is, you know, learning a whole lot of information. And so I think this is an area that is subject to Fourth Amendment regulation, but it really is the next stage of our understanding of constitutional norms in this context.
Well, Siobhan Gorman, you said it looks like a jump ball, and that is how it sounds in this hour, one of those moments when it may be, in fact, yes, that American citizens have to actively assert their assessment of what freedom and constitutionality must mean in this case. Very grateful to all three of you for being with us this hour. Jonathan Hafitz at Seton Hall Law School in New York. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Orrin Kerr at George Washington University School of Law. Orrin, great to have you as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Siobhan Gorman with The Wall Street Journal. You're terrific, Siobhan. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
In a moment, a celebration of the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. This is On Point. Today marks the 150th anniversary of the delivery of the Gettysburg Address, President Abraham Lincoln's historic speech on the Civil War battlefield that would come to broaden and deepen the American understanding of freedom and equality. Filmmaker Ken Burns, whose forthcoming film highlights the address, has created a website, learntheaddress.org, where people can post videos of their own recitations of the address. This celebrity mashup reading from the site features a reading by big names from Steven Spielberg to Taylor Swift to all five living presidents, all pitching in to read Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
47 years ago,
our fathers brought forth on this continent
a new nation, conceived in liberty,
and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war.
Testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure.
We are met on a great battlefield of that war.
We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place
for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live.
It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this.
But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate.
We cannot consecrate.
We cannot hallow this ground.
The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it.
Far above our poor power to add or detract.
The world will little note nor long remember what we say here.
But it can never forget what they did here.
It is for us, the living, rather,
to be dedicated here to the unfinished work
which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced.
It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us.
That from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause
for which they gave the last full measure of devotion.
That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain.
That this nation, under God,
shall have a new birth of freedom.
And that government of the people,
by the people, for the people,
shall not perish from the earth.
All five living presidents there, plus baseball's Shane Victorino, Bill Gates, Robin Roberts, Bill O'Reilly, Nancy Pelosi, and more, reading the Gettysburg Address from filmmaker Ken Burns' project, LearnTheAddress.org. For more about his project, encouraging people to learn and record Lincoln's great speech, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. Thank you, Abraham Lincoln. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.